From the weather report to political campaigns to the stock market, everything's about the future. Predicting it, owning it, winning it. For something that hasn't even happened yet, the future occupies an awful lot of our lives and thoughts. But why? Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, let's find out.
Hal, why do you think we're so obsessed with the future right now?
There's a lot of reasons, but the main reason is because we perceive the present to be a very anxious place. We have climate change, we have terrorism, we have unemployment problems. We're obsessed with the future because we want to get to a present that is not so anxiety-inducing.
That's Canadian cultural critic Hal Nidvietsky talking with Doug Gordon. Hal's the author of Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. It's a book in which he makes the case that as a culture, we may be for the first time in history more focused on the future than on what's happening right now. He thinks it's a kind of escapism. For example,
what is the fastest selling category of automobile in America right now? I'll throw that out to you, Doug.
Okay, thank you, Hal. We'll insert the Jeopardy music here. I'm going to guess sport utility vehicles? No. I give up. Kirill knows. Our technical director knows, but I don't know.
It is, in fact, the luxury SUV.
Oh, okay. So I was partly right.
You were partly right. That is the most popular category of vehicle in America. And you say to yourself, how is that possible with all the kind of enthusiasm and consternation around the environment and enthusiasm for electric vehicles and all this stuff? But then you look at the bigger picture, and Elon Musk, who is, of course, this billionaire technologist and the founder of Tesla Motors, the all-electronic car company, what does he put out? He puts out a luxury SUV Tesla, which costs $132,000. And when he puts this vehicle out into the world, he says, this car is so amazing, and here's the quote, it's like a car from the future. So there's this through line that tells us, you know what, we don't have to change. We don't have to consider making changes to our lifestyle in the face of all these problems. All we have to do is wait for people like Elon Musk to turn our luxury SUV into an all-electric SUV, and then our problems are solved. The future is coming.
Yeah. In his 2011 State of the Union address, President Barack Obama said that the first step in winning the future is encouraging American innovation. What does Obama mean when he talks about winning the future?
Well, I'm sure that he doesn't really have a sense of what he means in the sense that this is just rhetoric. These are lines tossed off by presidents, politicians, masters of technology and industry, and they're all running around saying, we have to have innovation, we have to win the future or own the future. When you think about this in the abstract, it doesn't mean anything, because how can you ever own the future, right?
Right.
The future keeps coming, and it can't be owned. On the other hand, there is an actual meaning that we're seeing in society. So the need to make this concrete is becoming more evident. And what actually is happening is we are fundamentally restructuring the institutions that make up our society and our culture in order to win the future or own the future or get to the future first. So when you look at education, when you look at government, when you look at how we organize the labor force, we see that all these things are being restructured to privilege this idea of owning the future. And the idea of owning the future essentially is that we need to constantly disrupt the present through technology in order to put the elements in play that will allow us to have a kind of total technological control of the time to come.
Yeah. This idea of disrupting the present is really evident in education. Schools are teaching the future. For example, USC opened a new program just last year, I believe, 2014, with the slogan, "The degree is in disruption." What's going on in education?
In the book, I devote a whole chapter to education because it really is a nexus where you can see how all this is playing out. So what we have is reordering of the education system to privilege getting to the future first. Everyone is coming up with new degrees which teach some variation on coding, entrepreneurship, and innovation. At the same time, we have a complete collapse of study in the humanities, underfunded, trying to kind of slowly diminish these programs. A great example is at Stanford, where the main degree is by far the computer science degree. And at Stanford, you have 45% of the faculty still teaching the humanities, but only 15% of the students take their classes.
Wow.
So you can see where this is going, right?
Yeah.
When these tenured professors retire, you can't really imagine them being replaced when no one's taking their classes. And of course, Stanford's a very rich university, and this is being reflected all over the U.S., where there are schools that are actually either canceling parts of their humanities programs or they're trying to redo them. So, for instance, at Brigham Young University in Utah, they renamed their entire humanities department Humanities Plus, shades of Google Plus. And in the Humanities Plus department, yeah, okay, you study a little English, a little history, a little philosophy, but more importantly, you partner up with the business students and you come up with innovations.
Yeah. As you say, there's this whole paradox here in this future-first education model, because education is traditionally a field that transmits past knowledge, things that have already happened. And now education is trying more and more to teach not what we already know, this body of common knowledge and history, but what we don't know. It's like students are attending Nostradamus High. What do you make of this?
I find it tremendously sad and kind of anti-human that we want to erase the past and focus squarely on the future. And the future is purely a technological thing. You know, it's the turn of a switch. It's AI and robots and downloading our brains into computers and living in virtual lives. The past is old and boring and human. The future is new and exciting and not human. It's profoundly anti-human. You know, the other factor, of course, is that there's the sense that the past won't help you get a job. And this is what really pulls the students, the schools, and the government funders all together in the same direction, is this belief that the students, there's no jobs for them if they just simply learn how to think about things. They have to learn how to be innovative and create. As Google put an ad for a product manager out there, and it said, they're looking for someone who can bring innovative, world-changing products to market. So that's the skill you need. You know, and to ask our young people, to ask anyone really, can you bring world-changing products to market? There's a reason we have an epidemic of mental illness in North American society, because these are the questions that we're asking and putting on people. It's very problematic, and it's very destabilizing for all concerned. There is comforts that come from learning about the past, learning about how your culture and society survived and grew.
One of the innovations you talk about is the use of big data to manage forests, and that seems like such a great thing that it's hard to argue with, and it raises the question how you think we should move forward in terms of finding this balance between the upside, the positive powers of digital technologies, and the downsides, antisocial and negative uses of digital technologies, like putting people out of work and things. Is there something that needs to be done, something we can do to find this kind of balance?
You know, that's a really hard question to resolve, because we are so psychologically attuned to the future, and we really see the future as something that will save us because of the way that we use the future in the past, in the times of prehistory. You know, we're still basically just kind of lizard people lying on rocks, you know, waiting for something shiny to fly by that we can eat. We haven't changed that much. So I think we need to start with that understanding that most people are extremely psychologically susceptible to narratives about the future, because they believe that that narrative will enhance the information they need for survival in the present day. And if we could all understand better that our desire for future is actually the desire for a more stable present, I think then we can start to ask these questions. Does this technology give us what we really want? What we really want is social certainty, continuity, community, and the assurance that we can, you know, live in our communities without being suddenly cast aside. You are now obsolete. So we have to look at each technology and say, how does this get us to what we really want?
Hal Nidbiedzki is the author of Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. He talked with Doug Gordon.